Downsize me, a hip, a hope, and a hurry up. Returning from Cyprus after burying my dad, the silence hit harder than the jet lag. Ermin had flown back to Australia. Everyone else slipped quietly back into their daily lives. And I came back to a house that felt cold, still, hollow. The kind of silence that doesn't just fill a room, it presses on your chest. Mum was still in hospital, but the doctors were hopeful. They'd adjusted her meds, prescribed iron supplements, doing everything they could to build her strength back up and keep her blood pressure stable. She was on the mend, a small mercy, a flicker of calm in a storm that had raged far too long. Then my phone rang. It was Martin. "Have you thought any more about the bariatric surgery?" he asked softly. I sighed. I had, of course I had. But the how felt impossible. He didn't miss a beat. "Fred and I are serious about this. We want to help. One of my mates raised the money for his cancer treatment through Facebook. Why don't you try the same? If it doesn't raise enough, we'll top it up. And if it raises nothing, we'll still pay the whole bloody thing. Just don't let this pass you by." I sat there stunned, phone still in my hand long after we hung up. The offer was so generous it felt surreal. But could I really crowdfund my own surgery, put it all out there for the world to see? Expose my pain, my body, my desperation? A few days later, I picked Mum up from North Middlesex. She looked frailer than I remembered, but her eyes lit up when we pulled into the drive. She lowered herself into her chair, glanced across the room, and froze. Dad's recliner sat empty, untouched. Her face crumpled. She didn't cry. She just started talking. She told me how they met, how proud he was when he joined the police, how hard he worked after they came to England. "He was good," she whispered. "Too trusting sometimes, but gentle. So loving," she murmured, eyes fixed on the empty recliner. Her voice cracked under the weight of grief. "He's left us. Why did he leave us?" I said nothing. Let her speak. Let her feel it. He was ill. His time had come, he knew. We didn't believe him, did we? We told him he was being dramatic, but he knew. Her voice dropped to a whisper, almost to herself. "He's left me. I am alone now, and soon, soon it'll be my turn." I knelt beside her, taking her soft, fragile hand in mine. Her fingers, once so strong, felt paper thin, tired. "It's not your time, Mum," I said gently but firmly. "And you are not alone. I'm here. I promised Dad I'd take care of you, and I will. You've got me." She didn't speak right away, just nodded slightly, eyes glistening. That was when I told her everything. About the surgery, about Martin and Fred and their astonishing offer to fund the whole thing if needed, about the clinic in Cyprus, the date, the urgency, and about my plan, because none of it would work if she was left behind, alone in that house, surrounded by echoes of him. So I told her. Her sister, living in Nicosia, had a live-in carer. What if she came with me? We'd travel together. I'd arrange special assistance for both of us at the airport, make sure the flight was manageable. I'd pay the carer to look after her for 10 days. Just 10 days, while I went through the operation and started to recover. And after that, we'd come home. Together. For a second, she just stared at me, saying nothing. Then slowly her eyes came alive, just a flicker but unmistakable, a glint of something I hadn't seen in weeks. "See my sister?" she said quietly. "In Cyprus?" I nodded. "Yes, you'd stay with her, be looked after, and I'd only be a few minutes away." She sat back, exhaling deeply, like her lungs had finally remembered how to breathe. The sadness was still there, but something else was growing in its place. Anticipation, connection, maybe even hope. A call was made, then another, and incredibly, both her sister and the carer agreed. Just like that, the impossible started to feel possible. That door I'd been banging on for so long, slammed shut by circumstance, fear, grief, finally creaked open. Mum was sorted. Now there were no more excuses. I picked up the phone and messaged Martin. Then I rang Josh. We arranged to meet at Fred's Cafe in Hillyfields, a place full of warmth and familiarity, the kind of local spot where the chairs wobble and the coffee's strong and honest. I walked in, nerves rattling beneath my skin, but determined. This was it. No turning back now. We sat, the three of us, at a corner table by the window. Josh opened his laptop, fingers already tapping. Martin ordered the coffee. I sat there, heart thudding. I turned to Josh. "No filters," I said with a dry smile. "Just me." "Just you," he replied. He snapped a photo of me right there in the cafe. No makeup, no pretense, just me. Then we wrote the post together and clicked publish. Campaign title, Fat, I need to downsize for surgery. Aim, I need to lose weight so I can have a new hip replacement. I'm currently on the NHS list for a bariatric sleeve. Been waiting months so far. In the meantime, arthritis in my hips and knees is making daily life unbearable. My left hip is bone on bone and needs replacing urgently, but doctors won't proceed until I lose weight. I found a reputable surgeon abroad, and surgery is booked for 28th April. Pre-op is scheduled for the 25th. Flights are on the 25th. I need 18,000 pounds by 25th April to make this happen. Anything you can give would be deeply appreciated. Thank you for reading and supporting this journey. And then we waited. I half expected tumbleweeds. Embarrassment. Pity. But what came instead was a quiet miracle. Hannah Meany donated 100 pounds plus gift aid. Good luck, I'm sure it will all go well. Ron Khalifa sent 500 pounds with a note, wishing you much success, Ison. David Tomlinson gave 100 pounds and a warm message. An anonymous donor dropped 1,000 pounds in with no words, just kindness. Then came the private messages, discreet transfers, quiet gestures that spoke volumes. Don gave 3,000 pounds. Alan, 2,500 pounds. David Castoriano and Leslie, 1,500 pounds. Friends I hadn't seen since Sally died. And suddenly it wasn't just about money. It was memory, love, and solidarity rolled into one. Within days, the full amount was raised. But Martin and Fred kept their word anyway. Miscellaneous, they grinned, each handing over 1,000 pounds just to make sure every base, flights, hotel, aftercare was covered. I was floored. Overwhelmed. A campaign I'd posted with trembling fingers had turned into a flood of support, love, and belief. I felt lighter before I'd even been wheeled into theater. With everything in place, I called Veral's office. They booked me into Pia Bella, a boutique hotel just a stone's throw from the hospital in Kyrenia. Surgery was confirmed for 28th April. Pre-op on the 25th. Flight set for the 25th. I was excited, not just for the procedure, but for everything it represented. A chance to get well, get active, and reclaim the version of me I'd almost forgotten existed. And more than that, going back to Cyprus meant one thing above all else. I'd get to see my dad again. Not in life, but in the red Cypriot earth. I'd go to his grave, sit beside him, and tell him what I was doing, that I was fighting for myself, for Mum, for my future. I knew he'd be there, listening, waiting. We flew into Cyprus on a warm, lilac-tinted morning, EasyJet into Larnaca. Mum and I, both with special assistance, no tags around our wrists, but we felt like we had VIP passes for the vulnerable. Her in a wheelchair, clutching her handbag like it held her whole history. Me beside her, trying to steady the nerves hammering in my chest. We were met on arrival by a transport team I'd prearranged, warm, efficient, and ready to whisk us off on the next leg of our journey. The plan was already in motion. First stop, across the border into the Turkish side, where Mum would stay with her sister in Nicosia. When they met, they embraced as if only weeks, not years, had passed since their last meeting. Two sisters, gray now around the edges, clung to each other as though time itself could be rewound in that single moment. Their laughter spilled out, their voices tumbling over one another in a blur of joy and disbelief. For Mum, it was a homecoming of sorts. Familiar walls, familiar streets, and the comfort of blood ties waiting on the other side. For me, it was the first step on a journey that would test every ounce of the promise I had made to Dad. Her sister's live-in carer stood ready to assist, and as I left Mum with a wave and a kiss, I felt a surge of something fierce and tender. I had done the right thing. Then it was my turn. We drove north through winding, moonlit roads toward Kyrenia. The island, as always, hummed with contradictions, dust and beauty, history and heat. My destination, the Pia Bella Hotel. Just a few minutes from the Bella Pius Monastery, home to the famed Tree of Idleness, where time itself was said to slow. I found that strangely comforting. Let time slow. Let me catch up with myself. That night I lay in my hotel room, sleep battling with anxiety. The moon poured in through the shutters. Tomorrow was the start of something I couldn't undo. By 9 a.m. I was walking through the polished corridors of the clinic, a place that buzzed with calm purpose. I met Varel first, my surgeon, measured, direct, quietly reassuring. He introduced me to Malik, my personal assistant for the days ahead. Malik, all soft footsteps and crisp efficiency, became my human compass, guiding me through the maze of pre-op protocol. Bloods, six vials, ECGs, chest x-rays, an ultrasound where I cracked a joke about whether they could tell if it was a boy or a girl. The technician smirked, but my nerves were betraying me. A shadow appeared on the heart monitor. My own heart skipped. They repeated the test twice more. No panic, no drama, just methodical, meticulous care. It was fine. I was clear. The efficiency was astounding. The cost? Shockingly low compared to UK prices. And yet the care was second to none. Part of my pre-op involved a camera being threaded down my throat into my stomach. I knew it was coming, but nothing quite prepares you for the moment when the gown is handed over and you're told to strip down and surrender to the process. I slipped into the thin cotton fabric, the kind that leaves you feeling half exposed, and was wheeled into the operating room by a kind nurse, with the surgeon walking beside us. Inside, I was introduced to the anesthesiologist, a man who took one look at me, raised his eyebrows, and I could almost hear his thoughts. "This one's going to need an extra dose." His eyes said it before his lips did. I was positioned on my side, heart pounding, while the nurse slid a cannula into my wrist. A sharp sting. Then another. "Ouch," I muttered, trying to mask my nerves with bravado, but the truth was clear. 2 needles, 2 points of entry, and nothing solid in my stomach for over 24 hours. Hunger gnawed, but fear overshadowed it. The nurse then fitted a thick rubber mouthpiece between my lips. Cold alien. I gripped the sheet beneath me, bracing myself. And then, darkness. When I opened my eyes again, it was as if I'd stolen a nap I hadn't realized I needed. A deep, dreamless, almost indulgent sleep. The procedure was over. Relief washed through me in waves. I hadn't felt the scope, hadn't gagged, hadn't even known it happened. Back at the clinic, reality resumed its steady march. My nurse greeted me with a sharp jab of a blood clot prevention injection. Daily, she explained, until Friday. By then, it would be down to me. On the evening of April 27th, no more solids after 6 p.m. At that hour, I'd have to make my own way to A&E and hand myself over for the big one, the main surgery scheduled for Saturday morning. I've even booked a car for the next 3 days. Tomorrow, I'll drive to visit Dad's grave, my silent confidant in all this. And after that, I'll likely see Mum and my aunt. Between now and Saturday, it feels like everything is suspended, hanging by a thread. The calm before the storm. After leaving the hospital, I returned to my base, Pia Bella. That odd little limbo between past and future, part sanctuary, part waiting room for the new life I was about to step into. But there was no rest for me just yet. I'd hired a small car, barely more than a tin can on wheels, but it did the job, and headed back across to Nicosia. I stopped in at my dad's village, had a quick word with him at his resting place, bringing him up to speed with everything that was happening. Once I'd said my piece and felt his silent company settle over me, I turned and made my way on to see Mum. I needed to see Mum, to check for myself that she was settled, comfortable, safe. I stopped at a little Burek cafe tucked along a dusty side street. Nothing fancy, but the kind of place where the air smelled of butter, spice, and something warm and familiar. I ordered a few meat and spinach bureks to take to Mum and her sister. The owner nodded, wiped his hands on his apron, and disappeared into the kitchen to prepare them fresh. While I waited, I sat by the open doorway, the heat of the afternoon thick around me, and sipped on a cold Sprite, the bubbles sharp and clean against the back of my throat. When the bag of warm pastries was handed over, I headed back to the house. She was there. In the shaded front room, the shutters drawn to block out the heavy sun, Mum and her sister sat side by side, two silhouettes in soft light, framed by lace curtains and old memories. They sipped tea from small glass cups, their quiet conversation barely above a whisper. It was a picture of stillness, of comfort, the kind of moment that needed no words. And when Mum saw me, her face lit up just a little. That smile told me everything I needed to know. She was safe. She was home. The sound of kilax, those strange little winged insects, filled the warm air, their soft chirping and rhythmic wing rubbing creating a kind of gentle, natural lullaby. The sunlight bounced off the iron gates and ceramic tiles, throwing golden flecks across the stone floor. She looked up and smiled when she saw me. Not just a smile of recognition, but of contentment. Genuine, bone-deep relief, and in that moment, I felt my own breath ease. My shoulders dropped, and something unclenched in my chest. She was okay. One less thing weighing me down. As I drove back toward Kyrenia, winding along the coast road with the sea winking to my left, I remembered I needed to sort my blood-thinning injections, the daily jabs prescribed before surgery. Somewhere along the strip that led to the Acapulco Hotel, I spotted a familiar sight, a parade of shops where Mardo Cafe stood out with its turquoise chairs and easy chatter. Tucked beside it, a pharmacy caught my eye. The sign above the door was striking. Blue background, white lettering, the font unmistakably similar to Boots. For a second, I could have sworn I was back in Sidcup. The name even started with a B, but this wasn't home. This was Cyprus. And when I stepped inside, I was greeted by air conditioning, polished floors, and surprisingly fluent English-speaking staff. I explained what I needed, pre-op anticoagulant injections, and they handed them over with practiced ease. No drama, no questions, just business. But to me, it was more than that. This wasn't just medicine. This was another step, another thread being pulled to unravel the old me. There was one problem, though. I couldn't bring myself to inject them. Varol had told me to do it myself, but the idea made my stomach twist. I asked, hesitantly, if someone at the pharmacy could administer them for me. To my surprise and absolute relief, they said yes. And so began the ritual. Each day, I returned to the chemist. One of the staff would greet me, lead me to the back, and inject the medicine, alternating arms to avoid bruising. The needle always stung the moment it pierced the skin, a hot, bright pinch followed by a slow, burning bloom that spread beneath the surface and lingered for 10 full minutes. I'd clench my jaw, inhale slowly, and whisper to myself, no pain, no gain, over and over, like a charm, like a prayer. These weren't just injections, they were mile markers, rituals, preparations for war. Every burn beneath my skin was a reminder that I was fighting for something bigger than comfort, bigger than fear. And as the fire in my arm faded each day, I felt myself inching closer, closer to the edge of the old life I was leaving behind, and one deliberate step nearer to the man I was about to become. Breathing exercises, leg lifts, packing and repacking my hospital bag like a nervous soldier preparing for the front line. The night before surgery, I gave a strange little goodbye to food. I joked about turning my removed stomach into a man bag and imagined it hanging from my shoulder in protest. Beneath the laughter, my hands trembled. Surgery day arrived not with fanfare, but with a harsh wash of fluorescent light and a tight knot of nerves curling deep in my gut. My fists clenched instinctively as the nurse approached, the IV line already primed in her gloved hand. "Just relax your arm," she said gently. I didn't. I pumped my fist, trying to coax a vein into visibility. She slipped the needle in, clean, swift, but the pain came anyway. A sharp sting followed by a dull, aching throb that didn't let go, even after it was taped down. I winced and asked her, half panicked, "Is it meant to hurt like this?" She smiled calmly. "Yes, it's normal," she said, hanging a bag of saline onto the metal trolley beside my bed, the tubing snaking its way down into my arm. A second nurse came in shortly after, holding a pair of white compression stockings. Without a word, she rolled them carefully up my legs, binding them tight around my calves. It was strange, this feeling of being slowly wrapped, prepared, packaged. My body was being handed over now, not to me, not anymore, and then nothing. Time stretched. Hours passed in silence, broken only by the low hum of other patients being wheeled in and out. No one told me when I was going in, no schedule, no countdown. Just the waiting, heavy and unkind. And then at last, movement. Someone, somewhere must have called my name. A nurse, a team, appeared at my side and gently unlocked the brakes of my bed. My heart leapt. This was it. They began to wheel me down the corridor. The lights above blurred into halos, one after the other, like soft white moons strung along a path I couldn't turn back from. The theater doors swung open with a cold finality, and that was it. Everything vanished. A flash of sterile white light, the sharp smell of antiseptic, the murmur of masked figures moving around me with clinical precision. I remember the cannula being checked, the warm rush of anesthetic surging up my arm. A nurse whispered something soft and rehearsed, comforting, meaningless. Then the ceiling above me began to drift, blur, spin. A silence so deep it roared, then oblivion. 2 hours slipped by, lost in the black. And then, resurfacing. Not like waking up, more like clawing my way out of a grave. I rose through layers of fog and darkness, dragging consciousness behind me like a broken limb. The first sensation wasn't relief, it was pain. Not sharp or sudden, but vast. Ancient. It throbbed through me like molten iron, searing each nerve, wrapping around my ribcage, crushing. Breathing felt like dragging glass through my lungs. I tried to speak, nothing. My tongue felt stitched to the roof of my mouth. I tried to lift my head, it wouldn't budge. My eyes opened only halfway, lids fluttering under the weight of exhaustion and anesthetic. My body wasn't mine anymore. It was a battlefield, torn, ravaged, ruled by pain. And in that raw, animal moment, the doubt hit me like a punch to the chest. What had I done? Had I really thought this through? Had I really signed myself up for this? I'd allowed myself to be butchered, cut open, rearranged, sewn shut, by strangers and scrubs. And the bitter truth was, they did it because I paid them to. I asked for this. I paid for this. Somewhere nearby, a faint buzzing, my phone. Messages, maybe. People checking in. But it felt 1,000 miles away, like a memory from another life. I was stranded inside myself. But beneath it all, beneath the agony, the haze, the brutal rebirth, one truth burned steady. I had done it. The summit had been reached. The climb was over. Now came the descent, slow, jagged, and necessary. But I was on the other side. The battle for healing had begun. That first night, sleep was impossible. Gas rose in waves, reflux seared, my mouth was dry. Every 2 hours, the nurses appeared like ghosts. Time to walk, they said. My body screamed, but I did it. And then came the moment I'll never forget. There were about 8 of us who'd gone under the knife that same day, now dressed in identical hospital gowns, tubes dangling from our bellies into transparent bottles filled with blood. We were told to walk the hallway together, to get our circulation moving, and so we did. I called it the walk of shame. 8 fatsos. As I irreverently called us in my head, shuffling down the corridor like some post-op parade of regret and resurrection. Heads bowed, eyes glazed, tubes swinging. Once we'd filled our bellies like foie gras geese, force-fed by habit, by hurt, by hunger that had nothing to do with food. Now we were ghosts of our old selves, blood trailing behind us like some grotesque offering to the gods of transformation. But we walked, because we had to. By the second day, I began sipping fluids, just water at first, measured, careful, reverent. With 80% of my stomach now gone, even a sip felt like a full meal. Water had weight, it took up space, it demanded respect. By the fourth day, the rhythm of recovery had dulled into a quiet ache, until the door creaked open and in walked Viral and Malik. Viral, ever the calm surgeon, approached with clinical grace. He examined my stomach, fingers firm but gentle, his face unreadable at first, then a nod. He was pleased. "You're healing well," he said, his voice low and matter-of-fact. "We've printed some instructions for you in English. Please read them." His tone suggested that was not a request. "Later you can change the bandages, clean the wound with iodine. Don't worry, it's all in the notes. I'd like to see you once more before you fly home. Make an appointment with Malik the day before your departure." Malik handed over the printed pack, thin sheets with small text and clinical diagrams I already knew I wouldn't read, and a few protein shakes I wasn't yet allowed to drink. I nodded, thanked them, and they left. Of course, I never read the instructions. I was officially discharged, cleared to return to the hotel. The hire car was long gone. No need for it now, so I called a local taxi. 10 minutes later, a gleaming silver Mercedes pulled up outside, purring like a cat in the midday sun. The driver stepped out, tan, smiling, warm. He took my small bag, waved off any fuss, and held the door open like I was royalty. The fare, £5. I nearly laughed out loud. A chauffeured ride, spotless leather seats, genuine hospitality, for less than a Starbucks, only in Cyprus. Back at the Pia Bella, the familiar scent of lemon trees and poolside chlorine wrapped around me like a welcome hug. At the front desk, I asked the receptionist, young, kind-eyed, about my injections. Blood thinners, once a day for 10 days. Her name was Zara, same as my mum. A strange little coincidence that landed gently in my chest like a whisper. "You're safe here." Without hesitation, Zara made a call. "A nurse will come to your room every morning," she said. "They'll alternate arms. Don't worry." The cost? Again, £5 a visit. I was starting to think £5 was the unofficial currency of kindness on this island. But Zara wasn't done. I confided that I couldn't shower properly yet, nervous about getting the dressings wet, unsure how to even begin washing my hair. She didn't flinch. "Wait," she said. 20 minutes later, a woman appeared at my door with a towel, shampoo, and a gentle smile. She washed my hair like I was a child. No rush, no judgment, just care. And all I could think was, this place, this country, these people, how had I never seen them properly before? A stranger's hands, warm and assured, gently massaging shampoo into my scalp. Who would have thought that would become one of the most unexpectedly tender moments of my recovery? There was something so human in it. No hospital glare, no sterile gloves, just care. Real, quiet care. By then, the sharp edge of the surgical pain had dulled to a manageable throb. But the old pain, the deep, familiar grind of knees and hips worn down by years of weight, still gripped me like iron shackles. Every step was a negotiation. Surgery may have reshaped my stomach, but my joints hadn't caught up, not yet. Then came day 6. A short taxi ride, 5 pounds, of course, to the dietitian's office. But nothing felt short anymore. Even the small things demanded effort. There were stairs, no lift. I stared up at them, suddenly aware of every muscle, every joint that had yet to forgive me. My body was still relearning how to carry itself, awkward, unsteady, like a newborn deer. Each step was a negotiation between determination and doubt. Inside, the atmosphere was calm, polite smiles, gentle voices, a sense of quiet routine. I was introduced, welcomed, a brief chat, soft and clinical. But beneath the surface, everything in me was still adjusting, still trying to find its footing in this new reality. And then, the scales. I hesitated. I wasn't sure I even wanted to know. What if nothing had changed? What if all that agony, all that doubt, all that surrender had left me exactly where I started? But I stepped on anyway. The number blinked to life. I glanced down, heart stuttering, 17 pounds. Gone. Just like that, not water weight, not illusion. 17 pounds of past, the weight of old habits, fear, failure, already behind me. Something shifted in me then. Not triumph. No, I wasn't there yet. But hope. Sturdy, cautious hope, rose like a small flame in the dark, 1 stone and 3 pounds. In less than a week, I froze, staring at the scale as if it might betray me. I stepped off, waited, then climbed back on, holding my breath. The same number, it was real, tangible, a beginning. Back at the Piabella, the hotel had transformed in my mind. It was no longer just a place to sleep, it was my sanctuary, my cocoon. The air was thick with the faint scent of lemon polish and the hum of cicadas outside. The staff moved like angels in aprons, their footsteps soft against the tiled floors, their voices low and reassuring. They brought steaming bowls of chicken stock, tangy ayran, and crisp apple juice. They never lingered long enough to intrude. Instead, they slipped in and out of my days with gentle efficiency, leaving behind the soft hum of kindness. Every gesture felt magnified, precious. There was still the matter of my injections, of course. The daily sting reminded me I wasn't yet free. It meant I couldn't fly home as planned. But fortune, for once, was on my side. I'd raised more money than just the surgery cost, and with that small buffer, I made a decision that felt both reckless and wise. I would stay. Another 2 weeks. To heal. To let my body catch up with my resolve. To move slowly, deliberately, instead of rushing back into the chaos of life. Each sunrise brought something new. I found myself standing taller, shoulders no longer caving in. I walked further, my legs remembering their purpose. Smiles came easier, lighter, as though my face itself was rediscovering what joy felt like. One morning, in the spirit of reclaiming myself, I decided on a small indulgence, just a toenail trim. Nothing fancy, nothing showy. When I mentioned it to the taxi driver, his eyes lit up. "My cousin has a salon. I'll take you," he said, as if unveiling some grand secret. Of course he did. This was Cyprus. Every need, every whim, had a cousin ready to meet it. I wasn't expecting anything more than a quick in and out. But what began as a modest request soon blossomed into the full treatment. A warm foot soak, a salt scrub, nails trimmed, buffed to a quiet shine, oils smoothed into my skin, a massage that untied knots I didn't know I carried. Creams, lotions, rituals layered one after the other until I was floating. And here's the truth. I surrendered to it. For the first time in a long time, someone was caring for me not out of duty, not because I was family or a patient, but simply because I was there. It was tender, deliberate, unhurried, almost meditative. I leaned back in the chair, toes sinking into scented water, and let out a quiet laugh. This wasn't what I had planned, but it was exactly what I hadn't realized I needed. No wonder women swear by this kind of care. It wasn't vanity. It was stillness. permission to let go, to feel human again. It felt indulgent, unfamiliar, and utterly exquisitely necessary. I sat at seaside cafes, iron in hand, letting the world unfold around me in slow, gentle rhythms. Waiters brushing crumbs from sunlit tables, old men hunched over backgammon boards beneath striped umbrellas. Life moved unhurriedly here, and for once so did I, and I wrote. It was my final week before flying home. I'd hired a car and made my way to see Varol, my surgeon. The visit started with a telling off. Apparently, I'd texted Malik asking if I could take paracetamol for my pain, when all the information I needed was right there in the English instructions they'd given me. If I'd bothered to read them, I would have known that painkillers were already included in the post-op medication pack. Then came the next question. Have you had a bath? For a moment I thought, blimey, was I really that bad? Truth was, I hadn't had a proper shower since Friday the 8th of April. I'd been too afraid of getting the wounds wet. He gave me a look and said, if you'd read the instructions, you'd know it's fine to bathe after the second day. Just be careful with the wounds. Point taken. He then peeled away the bandages. The wounds were healing beautifully, fast, clean, uncomplicated. He nodded with satisfaction, then smiled and congratulated me on the weight loss so far. There's more to come, he said. A lot more. Come back and see me same time next Friday, he added. And to my surprise, I was feeling better than I'd dared hope. My stomach was pain-free. The dressings were gone. I'd long since stopped using iodine. I was letting the warm Cypriot air do what medicine couldn't. No shirt, no fuss, just healing. That day, I hired a car. I decided to drive to Balapius. I took my seat beneath the old Tree of Idleness, a place once home to Lawrence Durrell. He had lived and written here, his words later captured in Bitter Lemons. I like to imagine him under that same canopy, letting his thoughts drift between language and light, waves and worries. He was a better writer than me, more poetic, more philosophical. But in that moment, we were just two men, decades apart, both trying to make sense of life beneath the shade of the same tree. I opened my laptop and began shaping the blueprint of a life I once lived. The Ultimate Coffee Shop Owner's Handbook, Strategies for Success in the Cafe Industry. I wrote what I knew, what I'd built, what I'd lost, what I'd survived. The scent of early morning espresso, the clink of tills opening at dawn, pastries in neat rows, the quiet comfort of regulars finding their spot each day. That world still pulsed in me, always would. And in those golden still moments, flip-flops brushing warm stone, a soft breeze on my skin, Aaron cool and salty on my tongue, I felt something shift. No pressure, no chaos. Just the hum of cicadas and the gentle clatter of cutlery nearby. In that quiet, unassuming ritual, I found something I hadn't felt in years. Peace. Next, I would drive to my father's village, sit quietly, tell him what I'd done, and let him know how much I missed him. Soon before my final appointment with Varol, I had my follow-up with the dietitian at her clinic in Kyrenia. This time, the waiting room was filled with people just like me, each carrying their own pain, their own reason, their own story stitched into their skin. There was a quiet camaraderie between us, an unspoken understanding in our eyes. One woman stood out. She introduced herself as Firdevs Kelebek. Her name, she explained with a smile, meant butterfly, and somehow she embodied it, light, fluttering, full of movement. Her eyes sparkled when she spoke, alive with something I hadn't seen in years, transformation, possibility. I lost 50 kilos in 9 months, she said, beaming with pride. Her voice carried the certainty of someone who had clawed her way back from the edge. She had taken her life back, and the energy around her was infectious. I couldn't help but smile. For the first time, I thought, my journey is only just beginning. We exchanged numbers, almost casually, but the spark was undeniable. Not long after, my phone lit up, WhatsApp, a new conversation was being born. Aysen, hi, this is Aysen. Pleased to meet you, X. Her reply was instant, as if she'd been waiting for it. That simple heart said more than words. It was warm, open, inviting. I told her about the weight I'd already lost in such a short time. Half shy, half proud. Congratulations, I'm really pleased for you. Where are you staying? Her enthusiasm leapt from the screen, each message coming quick, almost breathless. I'm very happy about it. I'll definitely visit. We can go somewhere for a drink. I'll pick you up. Let's make a plan. I sent back a thumbs up, amused by her eagerness. Within moments, my phone buzzed again. Ferdevs, my mom's visiting me. We're going to the pier on Sunday. If you'd like, we can pick you up and go together. Would you like to come on Sunday morning? Her words made me smile. An invitation. An opening. I'd love to. When you say pier, do you mean the old harbor or the new one? Either's fine. See you two then. A pause, then another buzz. Maybe we'll come to your hotel for dinner in the evening. I'll call you. But how are you feeling? Are you okay? No pain? She didn't stop there. We'll visit both piers. My mom wants to see a lot. I'll pick you up on Sunday morning. I really want you to come along. You'll love it too. Her persistence was flattering, unexpected. After so long feeling invisible, it was intoxicating to have someone, especially a younger woman, show interest. I felt seen, desired. Still, caution lingered. I typed back, Asen, hang on, I've got my daily injection at 10 a.m., can't really go out until after that. Dinner at the hotel's fine, though. You know I'm still not eating much, no real pain, everything slowly, slowly. Her response was immediate, accommodating. Ferdevs, if you want, we'll wait and go after your injection on Sunday. And yes, dinner sounds good. For a moment, I allowed myself to believe it. Maybe it was the weight loss. Maybe it was the new energy radiating from me, but her attention felt almost too good to be true. And then it hit me. That creeping, sinking feeling in the gut. The way her enthusiasm pivoted around meals, around plans that involve spending. Her warmth, her eagerness, it wasn't just about me. It was about what I could provide. The penny dropped with a cold thud. She wasn't a butterfly. She was something else entirely. A gold digger. And dinner, it seemed, wasn't about connection. It was about who would be picking up the bill. When her message lit up my phone, I'm already downstairs at the casino restaurant, a part of me bristled. Too quick, too rehearsed. I typed back, measured, almost teasing. Asen, enjoy your dinner. I'm still not eating, but if you fancy a drink, I'm at the pool bar. Minutes later, she appeared. No dinner. No evidence she'd been hungry at all. She breezed in with a smile, light on her feet, and claimed she wasn't eating tonight after all. I watched her carefully. Butterflies are supposed to flutter, spontaneous and free. She, however, was calculated in every step. We sat by the pool, our reflections trembling in the water's glow. She ordered a drink and I followed, if only to fill the silence. Her words tumbled out first, stories rehearsed, edges smoothed, delivered like someone told them many times before. I listened, nodding, waiting for something genuine to slip through. Then I spoke, sharing my story in return, pieces of myself laid out carefully, like offerings across a table. It wasn't unpleasant. There was no argument, no sting, but something was missing. That spark from the dietitian's office, the sparkle in her eyes that had once felt like light breaking through, was gone. What once seemed playful now carried the weight of performance. Charm, yes, but the kind honed with practice. When she rose to leave, she leaned in with yet another promise. The harbor, soon. The words hung in the night air as light and fragile as smoke. I watched her go, her figure dissolving into the casino's bright haze. My phone stayed silent. One day, two, a week. Nothing. Ghosted. Vanished. Just like that. The truth settled heavy in my chest, bitter and unshakable. She hadn't come fluttering into my life as a butterfly at all. No, she'd been circling for something else. A gold digger in disguise. The day before we were due to leave Cyprus, I sat once more in Varol's office. He examined me with the calm precision of a man who had done this 1,000 times. His verdict was simple. All good, healing as it should. A firm handshake sealed the promise that I would return in July for my follow-up. When we finally flew home, special assistance was arranged again, though this time I barely needed it. My body moved differently now. My clothes, once stretched to their limits, now hung loose and baggy as though they belonged to someone else. I walked lighter, not only in weight but in presence, in spirit. The pounds were falling away, but so too was the heaviness I had carried for far too long. I stood taller. I breathed deeper. For the first time in years, I felt as if I was stepping back into myself. By July, Cyprus called me back. My mother, the rest of the family, and I had been invited to my mum's sister's granddaughter's wedding. A grand affair at the Corineum Golf Resort, its rolling greens spilling down to the sea, framed by the Five Finger Mountains. I decided to make a week of it and hired my cousin Ada's villa. Ben came too, bringing his girls, their laughter filling every corner of the house. By then, I had already lost 4.5 stone. The transformation was written across my body, etched into my movements. On the flight over, for the first time in decades, I fastened my seatbelt without asking for an extension. A small click of the buckle, but to me it felt like a quiet triumph, a private victory no one else could measure. The villa was perfect, spacious yet intimate, with whitewashed walls that stayed cool under the hot sun, and a large communal pool that shimmered like liquid glass. It offered the best of both worlds, peace and privacy when I needed it, with the wedding festivities only a short drive away. More than anything, it gave me time with my granddaughters, Lorelei, Jax, and Charlize. We hired a car and explored the island, stopping at hidden beaches, crumbling villages, and bustling markets. Between adventures, I squeezed in another checkup with Varol. His verdict was unchanged, healing well, weight still coming down, everything ticking along just as it should. My family in Cyprus could hardly believe what they saw. Their words came in a chorus of astonishment. "You look so different, younger, healthier, happier." For once, I didn't bat their compliments away or hide behind a joke. I simply smiled, let the warmth of their words wash over me, and accepted. One afternoon, I drove out to my father's village. I dropped in on Ada and his partner Dilber. The house smelled like home, Dilber forever bustling, either elbow deep in the garden or stirring something fragrant in the kitchen. I sat in their living room, sipping something cold as the cicadas hummed outside. Just then, two of Ada's customers arrived. He was, after all, the local Helam man, making halloumi the old-fashioned way, selling to cafes, restaurants, anyone who wanted a taste of tradition. As they collected their order, we struck up conversation. In passing, I mentioned that I'd recently had bariatric surgery with a surgeon named Varol. Their reaction was instant. Their eyes widened, their faces lit up. "No way!" they exclaimed in unison. "We had the same surgery with Varol 2 years ago. They stood before me like living proof. The husband had shed 40 kilos, his wife 50. Their skin glowed with health, their smiles brimmed with pride. They radiated the kind of confidence that comes from winning a long, hard battle. After they left, I turned to Ada, eyebrows raised. "Your customers went to Varol too? How come you didn't say anything when I told you back in April why I was here?" Ada chuckled, shrugged with the ease of someone who had been holding back a secret, and said, "Of course I know Varol. Everyone in Cyprus knows Varol. He's known as the Butcher of Cyprus." He grinned, eyes twinkling, and added with a wicked laugh, "How could I have told you that before your surgery?" The weight was still falling away, and not just from my body. Each week I stood a little taller, moved a little easier, breathed a little deeper. The changes weren't lost on Don. He'd been watching me closely, almost reverently, as though my transformation gave him hope for his own struggles. One evening, over a quiet cuppa, he finally put words to it. "Mate," he said, shaking his head, "you're looking 10 years younger. Honestly, you've got a spark back." I smiled, but he wasn't finished. He leaned in, his voice low, a seriousness hanging there between us. "I need a new knee, but the NHS won't touch me. Diabetes. My sugars are too high. They told me, get your levels down or forget it, but I can't. It's a loop I can't get out of." He paused, staring into his mug as though the tea might answer back. "Could you ask, over there in Cyprus, do they have someone who does knees? And if they do, would they even look at me with the state I'm in?" It took just one call. Malik's answer was instant. "Yes, Dr. Utku Gurahan, one of the best. He'll take a look." We spoke to the man himself, and his calm precision carried weight. "We will monitor his sugar levels closely," Dr. Gurahan said. "We can do this. October is possible." That was all Don needed to hear. Hope flickered where despair had settled. On the 16th September, the five of us, Alan, Don, Ben, who would only stay a week, Mum, and me, boarded the plane for Cyprus. Ada had once again offered us his villa. That earlier summer trip had been about weddings and family gatherings. This one carried heavier stakes. Mum, just like before, crossed the border into Nicosia to stay with her sister. The moment they saw each other, the years melted away. Two sisters, both gray at the temples now, wrapped in each other's arms, laughing as though it had only been yesterday. Their voices rose, tumbling over each other in rapid Turkish, filling the room with a joy that spilled out onto the street. Watching her like that, my heart eased. She was home again. In the arms of her sister, in the comfort of familiarity. Doan's surgery was scheduled for Monday, 23rd September. The four of us walked him into the hospital. I couldn't resist sticking my head around Verrill's office door. He looked up, that familiar grin spreading. "Back so soon," he teased. "Not for me this time," I replied, nodding toward Don. "He's your next masterpiece." We left Don to be prepped. I squeezed his shoulder. "You'll be all right. I bloody better be," he muttered with a half smile. "And don't let Alan drink too much." Dinner that night was fish and chips. With Alan, foreign food was never an option. It was either English grub or a curry. Nothing else. I didn't mind. My meals were measured now anyway. Small portions, high protein, plenty of fluids. Carbs were rationed carefully or I'd pay for it later. Oddly enough, I didn't miss them. A few days later, I took Ben and Alan to my father's village to visit his grave. The air was heavy with stillness, the cypress trees whispering in the breeze. I introduced them to Ada, proud to share with them the cousin who had given us such a welcome second home. We also made time to visit Mum and her sister in Nicosia. Alan, at long last, met more of the family. The surgery itself went well. The new knee was in, but recovery was another story entirely. Doan's pain was deep, raw, unrelenting. I remembered my own agony after bariatric surgery, but his was worse, more invasive, more brutal. The painkillers dulled it, but never quite took it away. After 4 days, he'd had enough. "I want to come back with you lot," he insisted. "I need to be around people." The hospital hesitated, but eventually agreed with strict instructions. We had to attend physiotherapy every single day. No exceptions, no excuses. Ben's week was up. Ada drove him across to Larnaca Airport. On my way back from dropping Ben at Ada's village, my phone lit up, Alan. "Don doesn't look right," he said, worry raw in his voice. "His leg's swollen and red. He's burning up." One look at Don when I got back and the decision made itself. We went straight to A&E. No cues, no paperwork dance. They called Dr. Gurahan after hours. He came, assessed, and didn't sugarcoat it. Infection, IV antibiotics, readmit. The physio team folded back in as soon as they safely could. Alan, ex-football coach and all-round motivator, was there every session, coaxing and pushing in equal measure. Within days, Alan was lured away by his one true love, Millwall, the only call stronger than friendship. The thought of missing a home game was unthinkable. That season ticket was like a siren song, pulling him straight back to the den. That left just Don and me. I stayed on, nursing him, helping him to the hospital each day for physio, watching as he fought his way forward, inch by inch. One afternoon, we stumbled across a tucked-away restaurant not far from Ada's villa. Whitewashed walls, a terrace alive with bougainvillea, music threading softly through the air. The food was exquisite, easily the best we'd had on the island. The moment I tasted it, I knew. This was the place. The place to celebrate Mum's 78th. She hadn't marked a birthday with her sister, or her younger brother, in 22 years. I booked a table for 7th October. That night, our family gathered. Glasses clinked, live music floated across the terrace, and the air was thick with laughter. Mum sat between her siblings, radiant. At one of her brother's stories, she laughed so hard that tears streamed down her face, her shoulders shaking. For that evening, dementia, age, and worry fell away. She was just a sister again, young at heart, basking in the joy of being together. It was a night that etched itself into me, a moment suspended in time. After 4 weeks in Cyprus, Don was stronger, still aching, but walking. We flew home together. Back in the UK, life resumed. I had missed Iris's birthday on 16th October, but I made it up to her in November. Just the two of us in London. We strolled through Selfridges, her eyes catching every shimmer of the Christmas displays. We shared an alfresco Italian meal at St. Christopher's Place, heaters glowing against the crisp autumn air. And then the crown jewel of the day, the magic Christmas show at the Palladium. Blue were headlining, though the boys were men now. Iris laughed, clapped, and sang along, her hand tucked in mine, and I walked every step, no wheelchair, no wheezing, just me and my granddaughter, free at last to enjoy the day on foot. With strength came confidence, and I decided to try something I'd never dared before, a dating app. The first was a woman from Twickenham. We agreed to meet at the Shard. Weirdly, I was early, far too early. Me, of all people, I'm never early, waiting in the lobby while rain streaked down the glass. When she arrived, the concierge teased her for being late. She wasn't. I was overeager. It landed badly. I smoothed it over with a smile and took her up to the gong bar on the 52nd floor. The view was electric. London stretched out in glittering lights. A waiter brought nibbles. I picked, careful as ever. She tucked in with gusto, polishing off not one, not two, but three plates. I smiled. It didn't bother me. The old me might have done the same. We wandered to Borough Market. She told me her story. Made millions in her 20s, went traveling, a business lost, remarriage, divorce, then an American burger joint in Twickenham that failed. Now she was renting, bussing everywhere. At dinner later, when the waiter reached for my plate too soon, she snapped at him. "He's not finished!" She barked. I cringed for the poor lad. That flash of temper stayed with me. We ended the night in a jazz bar over London Bridge. Red lights, rhythm, the hum of music. I ordered my first whiskey sour in almost a year, and it tasted like freedom. At the end, I kissed her cheek goodbye. It had been fun, but she wasn't for me. She texted the next day to say the same. The second was Adele. Our chats flowed easily daily. She mentioned that her brother was a camera beer judge. I told her I'd written a book on how to open a successful coffee shop and, in passing, about an old cafe acquaintance of mine who had once brewed award-winning beer. Minutes later, a message pinged back from her with a link. My stomach turned as I read it. He'd been convicted of rape. I backpedaled immediately, putting as much distance between myself and that connection as I could. She brushed it aside, unbothered, and our chat carried on. We even fixed a date, Ramsgate. But then Ben rang. The girls wanted to go trampolining in Enfield. "You up for it?" he asked. Of course I was. I messaged Adele, apologized, rescheduled. She wasn't thrilled. At the trampoline park, my phone lit up. Boos! Ghosting, her way of saying she didn't believe me. I sent her a photo of me, Ben, and the girls mid-jump. But something inside me cooled. I canceled. The third was in Radlett, a cozy Italian, a quiet village near St. Albans. She was warm, Jewish, pretty, open. She told me her story quickly. Widowed young, remarried into violence, then 20 years with a man who drank and gambled her life away. He forged her signature, remortgaged the house, and left her with nothing. Her children turned away. I listened, gently asked if she'd had counseling. 4 years straight, she said. I told her I had too. But when I shared my own story, her eyes drifted to her phone. By the end, I paid the bill. A few days later, she thanked me for the birthday chocolates and card I'd given her, then wrote, "It's not you, it's me. I'm not ready." And that was it. No more apps. I came to see that most of them weren't really searching for love. They were searching for rescue, for security. And I wasn't here to play savior. I was still rebuilding myself. They wanted a man to steady the ground beneath them. And while I could offer loyalty, care, even love, I couldn't offer a home. Not yet. I was still living with Mum, and my own future, at least in bricks-and-mortar terms, was uncertain, fluid at best. Then came the letter. 10th April, 2025. My dad's birthday. My hip replacement day. The timing felt poetic, like he was there walking beside me, whispering courage into my ear. Mum had been frantic in the lead-up. She tried to hide it, but I saw the fear in her eyes, heard it in her voice when she asked about the operation. To her, surgery wasn't routine. It was risk. It was loss. She was terrified of losing me. Ben drove me in that morning. "Go on," I told him. "You've got work. I'll be fine." I walked in alone. The waiting room was thick with silence. When the anesthetist explained the spinal tap, I froze. "No. Knock me out," he chuckled kindly. "I understand, but awake is safer. Quicker recovery. Trust me. You won't feel a thing." Mr. Ahmed, calm and confident, came in soon after. "Awake is best," he said. I relented with a laugh. "I used to make sandwiches for a living. You replace hips. Do what you recommend." By 8 a.m. I was gowned and wheeled through sterile corridors. The spinal tap stung, sharp jabs, one after the other, until my legs disappeared beneath me. And then the soundtrack, the whine of the saw, the grind of the drill, the thud of the hammer. "Where's my hard hat and high-vis?" I quipped. "Feels like a building site in here." Laughter behind the masks. Surreal. But then it was done. Back on the ward, I braced for agony. It never came. No torment. Just calm. Professional hands had done their work. The nurse urged me to pass urine. I couldn't. The scanner showed my bladder 40% full. An hour later, 55%. Nothing. "If you don't, we'll need to insert a catheter." No thanks. I swung my legs over the bed, stood with the Zimmer, shocked to find no pain. Still nothing. In the end, the catheter went in, uncomfortable, undignified. But it worked. The Spinal Tap had numbed my bladder longer than the rest of me. By the next day, I was walking, Zimmer, then crutches. By the third day, discharge was planned. Visitors came, Josh and Ramey, Alan and Don, my sister and Sammy. Saturday morning, Ben drove me home. Ermin had booked the week off to stay with Mum and me. Later that evening, Mum called. "Are you all right, Olam?" she whispered, her voice trembling with relief. For days, she had carried fear like a stone in her chest. Now she could finally put it down. 2 weeks in, I was on one crutch and back behind the wheel. 2 months later, fully healed. The chronic pain that had haunted me for years, gone. Just the dull honesty of muscles stitching themselves back together. No painkillers, not even paracetamol. One hip gone. One carved out and replaced with steel and willpower. One battlefield survived, one still waiting. Then the knees. Pain didn't frighten me anymore. Pain had become familiar, an old adversary I'd learned to stare down without blinking. 6 weeks after the surgery, I walked into Mr. Ahmed's office upright, steady, defiant. He looked up, recognition flashing across his face. "You're the gentleman who asked for a hard hat in theater, aren't you?" he said, grinning. "Guilty," I replied. He shook his head, amused. "So, tell me, when can I do the other hip? When can I have it done?" I shot back instantly. He laughed. "If I do the other hip now, you won't have a leg to stand on." We both burst out laughing, but beneath that laughter was something else. This operation hadn't just rebuilt bone. It had stripped me down, sharpened me, cleared years of emotional fog I didn't even know I was walking through. When your body is cut open and rebuilt, something happens to your mind. You stop tolerating nonsense. You stop romanticizing pain. You stop mistaking chaos for passion. I thought about the women I had met over the years, the gold diggers, the charmers, the ones who wrapped need in the language of love, the narcissists who drain you slowly and call it devotion. I'm done. Completely done. Illusions are expensive. They cost you time, they cost you dignity, they cost you peace. And I have paid enough. What I want now is simple. Truth, empathy, real connection. No performance, no manipulation, no hidden ledger of who owes what. And the strangest thing of all, I already have it. In my sons, in my grandchildren, in the family who stayed, in Mum, still laughing with her sister, still needing me, still grounding me, watching dementia circle her now, slow and cruel, taking her piece by piece, and knowing I will not look away. I will stand, I will stay, as she always did for me. That is real. That is enough. And yet, Diane still drifts into my thoughts sometimes. Not the woman, exactly. More the ghost of what I believed we were. She rode the storm beside me, until the waves grew too high. When bankruptcy came crashing through the door, she stepped back, and I drowned. Worse than that, she tried to send Fred and me to prison. Silence where there should have been loyalty. Distance where there should have been unity. That wound took longer to heal than any joint ever could. But here's the uncomfortable truth. Was she the narcissist? Or was she simply a mother who never bent when it came to her children? She was loyal to them with a ferocity I now understand. She never deferred, never compromised where they were concerned. I, on the other hand, bent. I tried to keep everyone happy. I failed my sons when they needed me most. Was she wrong to deceive me? Would another mother have chosen differently? Am I wrong to judge her? Did she manipulate me, or did I simply refuse to see what was there? I don't know. And maybe finally I don't need to, because it no longer defines me. Here I stand now, 9 stone lighter, lighter in body, lighter in spirit, stronger than I've been in decades, more honest with myself than ever before. One hip rebuilt, one to go. Watching time do its quiet work on Mum, waiting in hospital corridors, facing reality without flinching. I will be there for her, as she was always there for me. As for what comes next, I don't chase anymore. But perhaps one day I will meet someone again. Not someone looking for wealth. Not someone hunting security. Not someone measuring status. But someone with heart. With empathy. With depth. Someone who values honesty over appearance, compassion over control, trust over drama. The things I hold sacred now. Because at last, after all the surgeries, all the betrayals, all the illusions, I know what is real. And for the first time in a very long time, I am free to live it.